consistent with the narrative of the hoax. But these aliens are real. It doesn't matter that the aliens in Walker and Closter's story were totally made up, because these aliens aren't. You know that lying doesn't come easily to me, but this isn't a lie. Okay, a hoax got the ball rolling, but the messengers are real. They deliberately intervened in a way that didn't expose the hoax, and that's the only reason I can live with this secret. But our secret isn't that everything was a hoax, he went on. It's that everything started with a hoax. They wouldn't have had to intervene if the hoax hadn't led to DS1, but everything since then is legit. And remember the main part. They actively decided to engrave the third plaque in a style that matched the other two. That's the most important thing of all, because they've now shown that they're willing to use the communication symbols and methods that Walker and Closter established first. To put it as simply as I can, the messengers are willing to speak to us in the language of those first two plaques, just like they're willing to use Kerguelen as an important site. They want to communicate with us again, but they want to do it without exposing the hoax. As Dan intimated, when the third plaque had been discovered in a Salzburg storage locker the day after Dan and Emma conversed with the messengers, the plaque's location and the identity of its lucky finder had made perfect sense within the context of all that went before. The third plaque, created by Walker and Closter, but truly engraved by intelligent extraterrestrials, provided convincing context for the first two, and it was a context which explicitly quashed all fears of hostility. The lie came true, Dan said. I know it was a lot easier when everything was black and white and all we were trying to do was expose what we thought was a cover-up, but this is the situation we're in. I don't want to get too caught up in terminology, but I can't just sit here and listen to you tell me that it was all a hoax, because these aliens are as real as the nose on your face, and they're coming back. Clark nodded slowly. I obviously know they're real, man. Fair enough, I didn't get into their craft, but I was at Lolo too. I know the message on the third plaque was engraved by real aliens, and that even though it wasn't part of the hoax, it was inspired by the hoax. What I don't get is why you think they would do something like this at Kerguelen. There's something they need to tell us, Dan said. We know their M.O. Minimal, necessary intervention. They don't care about human constructs like truth and lies, and I can't imagine they give much of a shit about our stupid politics. We don't know if minimal, necessary intervention is part of an unbreakable moral code, an edict, or whatever else. All we know is that they live by it. Planting a third plaque was the least invasive way to calm the shitstorm caused by Walker's lies, and it was the least invasive way to make sure we wouldn't feel like we had to try to launch another nuclear-armed space station after DS-1 failed. That's why they planted it. This bolide at Kerguelen was so public and so visible that it can only mean they want to get everyone's attention. And quickly. Clark looked at Emma. Do you get what he's saying? There's not all that much to get, she said. I was face-to-face with them just like Dan was, and it's definitely true that they went out of their way to stop the DS-1 launch without revealing themselves. And it's also definitely true that after Lolo, they went out of their way to calm everything down without destroying everyone's sense of reality. That's a word Dan didn't use, but it's an important one. This whole narrative has been the basis of everyone's reality for the past year. When one person finds out that their entire concept of reality is built on a lie, that's a very difficult thing to take. But when a whole planet finds out... Dan leaned back. So you're both finally coming around to the reality that this wasn't random chance, it wasn't a false flag, and it wasn't a PR stunt? You're coming around to the reality that they really are telling me something? It looked to me like they were trying to tell everyone something, Clark said. An explosion over Kerguelen isn't exactly subtle. Emma? Dan asked. I've got one question, she said. You said that if the messengers do something that hints at other locations, you'll know where to look, yeah? Dan shrugged. Yeah? Emma held his eyes. Look for what? Dan rose to his feet, stepped behind the desk, and pressed his fingertips against the wall. It parted at the center to reveal itself as a false wall, and in doing so, it exposed a room-length magnetic whiteboard, which was overflowing with scribbled notes, rough drawings, and paper printouts. As Emma and Clark looked up at it, all in stunned silence, Emma's hand covering her mouth and Clark's eyes darting around uneasily, Dan sat back down beside them. "I knew something like the Kerguelen bolide was going to happen eventually," he said, drawing a line in the air from one side of the wall's annotated workspace to the other. "That's why I'm ready." C-92. Drive-in, Birchwood, Colorado. Henry McCarthy passed under a giant arched drive-in sign as he neared the entrance of New Kerguelen Bar and Grill. The old drive-in lot, which had been officially rechristened Birchwood Plaza following its ascent to global renown as a popular location for news reports and grand speeches in the aftermath of Dan McCarthy's alien exposé, had since been renamed Birchwood Drive-In, with minimal fanfare. Locals had always known it simply as The Drive-In, while out-of-towners who came to visit the famous site knew it as The Birchwood Drive-In. And Phil Norris, a McCarthy family friend who purchased the empty lot for next to nothing many years earlier, ultimately accepted Emma's advice that it was time to stop fighting the tide and embrace a full rebrand. Given the evening's events, Henry had a feeling that Phil would be glad he hadn't also changed the name of New Kerguelen, a play on the common designation of the aliens' still unlocated home planet as New Kerguelen. While Phil had wisely kept the giant screen and makeshift scaffold stage in place from the previous year, keen to retain the iconic backdrop to draw as many photo-hunting tourists as possible, several popular outlets had moved into the storefronts of the U-shaped lot. These included flagship branches of Man-Size Clothing and Beanstalk's Coffee, both of which sought to capitalize on the expensive commercials they had shot featuring Dan the previous year. The coffee shop was brimming with customers as Henry headed for the grill, and a young couple were happily posing for pictures against the world-famous backdrop. Birchwood was thriving like few could remember. Town pride was high, too. Locals no longer said they lived just south of Colorado Springs, and many who lived in between now gave their location as a few miles from Birchwood rather than a few miles from the city. Everyone in Birchwood had benefited from the tourist income, but few, if any, had done as well as Phil Norris. The rejuvenation of his long-dormant drive-in lot had enabled him to get out of the pawn shop game, watching on indifferently as his old shop's new owner turned it into an alien-themed tortoise trap which sold everything from tiny meteorite fragments to expensive life-size replicas of the messenger's engraved plaques. These kinds of tortoise stores were common in and around Birchwood, with another large concentration near Richard Walker's old IDA building in Colorado Springs. Phil caught sight of Henry's arrival and walked right over to greet him, grinning like a mouse in a cheese factory.
"Can you smell the money, Henry boy? Business is about to explode like a meteor."
Henry laughed as he made his way to the bar. Phil's entrepreneurial spirit was hard to beat, but he certainly wasn't the greedy or selfish man many might have assumed after a short meeting. He'd always been generous to the family and, by all accounts, had been very accommodating during Dan's undesired spell in the public spotlight, when Henry was hospitalized and unable to help. Phil had done well out of Dan's spotlight, too, of course, and Henry could once again see dollar signs spinning in his old friend's eyes. An even older friend, Walter Byrd, then turned to greet Henry from his seat at the bar.
"How's Dan?" was the first thing the softly spoken man asked.
Henry knew that his longtime neighbor had been even more helpful than Phil during the roughest months of the previous year, going beyond the call of duty by inviting Dan into his home and sticking by his side on live TV when a televised hypnosis went wrong.
"He's doing okay," Henry said. "Got a hell of a fright when he saw the news, but Emma and Clark are there."
Walter, a former sheriff's deputy known as Byrd to his close peers and Mr. Byrd to everyone else, looked concerned.
"What kind of fright? Does he think the meteor might have something to do with, you know?"
"Aliens?" Henry scoffed. "Nah, it'll be strange for him to see Kerguelen and Kendrick back in the news. But I don't think he was bothered by the anchors talking about hostility and Walker and all that crap. It was just a shock to see Kerguelen."
"It's better not to watch the news,"
Mr. Bird said after a long and slow sip of his beer.
Negativity for breakfast, fear for lunch and dinner.
Speaking of dinner, Henry said, pointing over his shoulder towards the dining section of New Care Grillin. Mr. Bird patted his stomach.
I ate at home. We don't all have one of those free meal cards, you know. McCarthy's only.
Henry laughed. I'll be quick. You sticking around for the whole game?
Looks like it's over already,
Mr. Bird said as he glanced up at the lopsided scoreline.
But yeah, I'll be here.
Henry then took his spot at the dining area's McCarthy table, where regular customers could sit for an exorbitant fee during certain times of the day. The genuine manila folder Dan had found on the street outside the IDA building adorned the wall in a high-security frame. It was empty, with Hans Kloster's handwritten letter and all of the other contents stored even more securely in Phil's impenetrable vault. But the word Kerguelen on the front of the folder was enough to draw visitors from near and far. Phil would never forget Dan's kindness in donating the folder to the grill, and even after this many months, it still seemed like the public would never tire of looking at it. In the bustling dining area, one TV showed the game while the other, muted, was tuned to Blitz News. A short feature was coming to a close on the topic of a widely disliked group of self-styled extremists known as anti-dotalists, an offshoot of an already radical anti-natalist pressure group whose manifesto described humanity as a scourge on its unfortunate home planet. The anti-dotalists, who presented themselves as non-violent and drew their name from their belief that humanity was a virus to which deliberate self-destruction was the only antidote, were known for direct action, including intimidation campaigns against life extension researchers and industrial-scale agricultural sabotage intended to bring about localized famines. Billy Kendrick was one of many outspoken critics of the group, repeatedly arguing that they hid behind the term environmentalist and risked tarnishing it beyond repair. "These people are not environmentalists," he had said a few months earlier in an interview Blitz News had now decided to rerun in reaction to the fact that prominent online antidotalists were currently celebrating the Kerguelen bolide as a harbinger of a potentially imminent and long overdue cataclysm.
"Egotistic, nihilistic, solipsistic,
yes," Billy said, "but not environmentalist. Apologies in advance for the flippancy and potential insensitivity of my next comment, but these people belong in the environs of a mental hospital, and that's the end of my thoughts on the matter." After Billy's face left the screen at the end of this brief feature, it was replaced by the trademark scowl of Joe Crabb, a radio shock jock turned media commentator who had been vocal in his opposition to William Godfrey's GSC for longer than anyone else. The subtitles below Crab's face relayed his usual talking points.
GSC power creep, American sovereignty, the road to tyranny.
And the blood vessels in his neck looked fit to burst through the skin. When prodded on the subject of Richard Walker, Crab then reverted to his usual role as an IDA apologist. Although almost everyone else in Birchwood detested Walker with a burning passion, Henry McCarthy didn't see the world in black and white. He had supportively followed Walker's political career for decades, admiring his storied military background and his refusal to bend whichever way the wind was blowing. Henry and the rest of the world now believed that Walker was responsible for a cover-up. The far-fetched idea of a Machiavellian hoax didn't even enter anyone's mind, but Walker's motive of protecting American interests above all else was one close to Henry's heart, and one which somewhat tempered his anger over the deceit. Mr. Bird, on the other hand, was firmer than anyone in his disdain for Walker, to the extent that his normally placid demeanor tended to go out of the window whenever Henry expressed anything less than full-on hatred for the man responsible for piling so much misery on Dan. Mr. Bird insisted that Henry would despise Walker more than anyone if he'd been there in person to see what Dan had gone through a year earlier, when Walker brazenly took to the airwaves to call him an opportunistic liar and accuse him of being a Chinese agent spreading anti-American propaganda. As Henry read Crabb's next comments, Phil arrived at the McCarthy table with a giant smile still etched on his face.
"You know what, Henry? Tonight your meal card is even valid on the lobster. What do you say?"
"Did you bang your head on something back there?" Henry asked. Phil roared with laughter and dived into a brief and nostalgic conversation about the glory days when his lot had been the backdrop for countless daily news reports beamed into hundreds of millions of homes.
"And last time out," he said, "the lot's storefronts were pretty much all empty. Think of the business we'd do now if something else happens and this Kerguelen story picks up speed.
Just don't expect the boys to get involved in any more of that media crap," Henry said. "And not because I'm back in the picture, just because they've had more than enough of that for one lifetime. You would do well, for sure, but don't expect them to be here talking to anyone. Not Emma neither. She's got a good thing going with her consultancy."
"I don't know about that," Phil said, still smiling. "Emma Ford, now there's someone who reminds me of myself, Henry boy. You know what I mean? I don't think that girl ever met a revenue stream she didn't like."
Henry shook his head.
"The last thing any of them want is to get caught up in any more publicity. Trust me. Dan especially. He's probably over this whole meteor thing already. But either way, he's not going to do or say anything that would put him back in the public eye."
"If you say so," Phil said, backing away.
"Anyway, one lobster coming up."
"Get one for Bird as well," Henry requested.
"Meal cards are only valid for the name holder," Phil winked. Henry shrugged.
"In that case, how about getting two for me? And if Bird happens to come over..."
"Just this once," Phil grinned, sighing in mock defeat. "After all, your boys did build this place."
C-91. McCarthy Residence, Birchwood, Colorado. Emma and Clark both rose to their feet, still staring in silence at the remarkably thorough research that filled an entire wall of Dan's basement. He watched them, studying their initial reactions. Clark pulled his head back slightly and furrowed his brow, almost squinting, as though looking at something much further away. Neither Clark nor Emma asked again what Dan thought they might soon have to look for. His extensive research, they could immediately tell, centered around his preparation for the messenger's planting of the fourth and final plaque. Emma moved first, heading for the leftmost section of the huge whiteboard. Her eyes were immediately drawn to this section by its huge poster of the third plaque, much of which was densely annotated and covered in enough geometric shapes to suggest that Dan had evidently spent many hours searching for spatial relationships and mathematical clues that just weren't there. But more eye-catching than the fear-busting planetary representation which the messengers had engraved at the bottom of the third plaque was what they had engraved above it. This was the engraving that had captured Emma's attention just as it had captured the world's imagination. Two accurately scaled representations of the very extraterrestrial beings that she and Dan had encountered in person at Lolo. Emma stared and stared. Even in this relatively crude metallic engraving, their startling eyes were evident. The large size of this poster brought the memories back more vividly than ever, and Emma could now picture the beings as if they were really there. All over again, the alien's large primate-like eyes struck her as not only intelligent, but kind. She eventually moved to the right, shifting her focus to the central section of the whiteboard. A series of maps filled this section, and Dan's annotations made it very evident that he was tracking search traffic in certain areas which had been particularly popular with the millions of citizens who gleefully took up the hobby of hunting for the fourth plaque every weekend. As well as the United States, and Colorado in particular, there were a handful of maps of the broad region around Germany and Austria, which some saw as the fourth plaque's most likely hiding place. There was also one very large and very detailed world map, with prominent pins marking the key hoax-related locations and smaller pins holding variously colored pieces of string, forming all kinds of carefully measured shapes between all kinds of carefully chosen places. Clark, meanwhile, had by now moved to the rightmost section of the wall. There, he stared uneasily at an incredible number of press clippings and handwritten notes about Carl Helig, the late archaeologist whose daughter had found the third plaque in his abandoned storage locker. To Clark, the level of attention Dan had paid to Helig and his family was less impressive than disconcerting. "This is the kind of thing you see when they catch a serial killer," he said, gazing at headshots and short biographies of Helig's distant relatives, as well as a detailed record of his employment and travel history.
"Seriously, man, what's with all this Helig stuff?"
"I think Helig might be a lot more important than we think," Dan said. "The engraving on the third plaque is the only real physical alien message we have, so there has to be a lot more to it than meets the eye. I'm not the only person who's looking for a hidden mathematical code, and I'm definitely not the smartest person looking for one. But no one else is paying enough attention to Helig. As far as I'm concerned, Helig is part of the message. They chose him for a reason."
"But didn't they put the third plaque there because that's where Emma suggested?" Clark asked.
"I only suggested Austria," Emma jumped in, recalling the surreal moment when her mind had interpreted a communication with an extraterrestrial being as a question as to what she saw as the best way to deliver the third plaque's necessary message in a manner consistent with what had gone before. "We didn't exactly speak to the messengers. It was more like we could hear their thoughts in our own inner voices. And when I heard the question about where I would put the plaque, all I said for sure was Austria. I might have said something about a locker, but it's difficult to say. It wasn't anything like regular talking. Right, Dan?"
He nodded.
"But when we got out of the craft, you definitely said something out loud about Austria, and that was before the plaque turned up. Austria is a pretty big place, though, and that's why it doesn't make sense for us to shrug our shoulders and think they chose Helig at random. That's why I've been looking into his life and work. I think he's a clue, and I think they want me to work this out."
Clark moved slowly towards the center of the board.
"And these maps?"
"A lot of people are already looking for the fourth plaque," Dan said. "Especially since Timo put up the huge reward. Obviously, we know that the hoax's narrative isn't true, and that the real messengers held on to the fourth plaque in case they'd ever need it. Which I think might be what's happening now. But it's important for me to know where people are looking."
"Why?"
Clark asked, beating Emma to the punch by a fraction of a second.
"Because if and when the messengers plant the fourth plaque, they might want to plant it somewhere where they know it will be found quickly. They could be tracking the searches just like I am, so I need to make sure I stay on top of this."
Clark no longer looked overly concerned, as he had when taking in Dan's Helig research, but he was still hesitant.
"Listen, man, I understand all of that. I really do. And I'm trying to understand all of everything. I just think that we shouldn't get ahead of ourselves. Pretty much every ancient and modern religion in the world has been waiting for someone or something to return. It's the most natural thing in the world to want. I don't know. I think I'm trying to say that you're not crazy for thinking this could happen, but that doesn't mean it makes sense to expect that it will happen."
"How is this the same thing at all?" Dan asked. "I'm not waiting for God or for a prophet. I'm not waiting for anything. I'm actively looking for the truth, just like Emma said."
"When did I say what?" she chimed in.
"Remember at Walker's on the way home from Lolo, you said you didn't luck out and land on the truth by accident. You tracked it down and went after it. That's exactly what I'm doing now."
"You still remember my exact words?" Emma asked.
"Of course I do."
Clark held his hands up, palms out. "Sorry to break up this little memory contest, and I'm sorry to say this at all, but Dan, back then you were so focused on finding the truth that you ended up falling for a lie. I know it came true. I'm just saying, when people are desperate to believe something, they'll believe anything."
Dan couldn't be angry at Clark. He couldn't help being skeptical, and he wasn't being overly argumentative. But Dan didn't feel like defending his position against a point that didn't merit a response, so he ignored it entirely. Instead, he turned back to Emma and spoke directly to her.
"Earlier tonight, when we first came down here, you said that no ideas were off the table. No judgment, you said, remember?"
"Go on."
"Okay," Dan said. "I never want to be a public figure ever again. But if I can assist in the search for the fourth plaque, once we know it's definitely on Earth, I have a duty to help. Maybe we could work something out to help Timo or someone else find it, without us having to be publicly involved. We could maybe work out a way to tell him some of the real truth without dumping the whole secret on him.
just enough to help him find the plaque.
I don't want to go back to the craziness of last year either, Emma replied.
No more courting publicity. We're 100% on the same page there.
Dan nodded, glad to hear it.
And what about the other part of what I said?
Clark then walked over to Dan, surprising him by placing a gentle hand on his shoulder.
It's been a long day, he said. No judgment, like we said, but I think you should get some sleep and come back to all of this stuff when your head is clear.
Clark's words were spoken quite softly, and the tone Emma used next was even more gentle.
I totally get that you want to look for new angles, she said, and I know you're trying to make sense of a million things at once, but if the messengers want to tell you something specific, they'll make sure you hear it. Try to get some sleep, okay? Don't stay up all night.
I won't, Dan said.
He was pleasantly surprised by their muted reactions to an idea he'd been thinking about for much longer than the hour or so since the Kerguelen bolide hit, and he knew when to stop talking.
Good, Emma nodded. And remember, Dan, what's meant for you won't pass you by.
It would if I lived my life with my eyes closed, he said.
Your eyes were closed when they called you to the cornfield, Emma retorted.
A smile, touche-tinged, crossed Dan's face for the first time all night. Halfway to the stairs, Emma put her hands beside her head in the universally understood sign for sleep and gestured with her head towards his bed.
Sleep tight, Dan McCarthy,
she said, talking in the deliberately annoying, chirpy tone he remembered from the first few times they'd ever met. He couldn't help but laugh.
Night, Emma.
C-90. 10 Downing Street, London, England. In the early hours of the British morning, Prime Minister John Cole was toasting a long-overdue good day alongside his most trusted associate, the inimitable Jack Neal. After what had been their best day in a while, thanks to the low turnout at a high-profile but rain-disrupted march against Cole's recently introduced measures to beef up digital surveillance and extend policing powers, the pair's mood had risen significantly further with the recent news flash from the remote island of Kerguelen. An isolated and once esoteric location whose name was now as familiar to the majority of the world's population as London or Beijing.
What do you think that thing is? Cole asked, watching the footage of the meteor's atmospheric entry for the dozenth time. He spoke relatively slowly in his newly moderated accent, the introduction of which had been one of Jack's first orders of business in his bid to increase the Prime Minister's aura of gravitas. Jack, the Machiavellian PR guru who had broken Emma Ford into the business a decade earlier before turning his own attentions to the even murkier world of political strategy, looked away from the screen and flashed his usual devious grin at Cole.
It doesn't matter what it is, boss, he said, pausing again to take a sip of his late-night espresso. What matters is what we can do with it.
We use it against Godfrey, Cole said, as though answering a question. We paint the GSC as impotent. The question is, how and when?
And the answer is, later, Jack replied. Much of his work with Cole involved tempering the Prime Minister's instincts to relentlessly and thoughtlessly attack all perceived enemies. Few could strike fear into their opponents as effectively as John Cole, but no one could channel Cole's aggression like Jack. It doesn't matter who hits first. What matters is who hits hardest.
Cole nodded. Jack had a way with words, and his instincts were rarely wrong. Not a day went by without Cole feeling grateful that Jack had left President Slater's side to join the then-ascendant Godfrey, and he was even more grateful that Godfrey had since discarded Jack as unnecessary after moving out of the political limelight to concentrate on his job as GSC chairman. For, like Cole, Jack Neal now bore a grudge against William Godfrey, and as Cole had always known, a powerful ally with a shared enemy was the best friend a boy could have.
My only concern is what happens if the media pull McCarthy back into the picture, Cole said. Everyone else we can predict and deal with, But what if he gets pulled into this and chooses the wrong side? Do we have any emergency ammo there, like we do for Godfrey and Slater?
Don't worry about that, boss, Jack said with a sycophantic wink. We don't have much ammo to hurt McCarthy himself, but as long as Emma Ford stays by his side in Birchwood, I'll have a million times more than we could ever need.
C-89. McCarthy Residence, Birchwood, Colorado. Upstairs, Emma sat pensively at the kitchen table while Clark rooted around in the refrigerator. Her eyes kept being drawn to the back door at the far end of the room, the same door that Ben Gold had desperately pounded on the night of the DS-1 launch disaster when he arrived to tell Dan that Richard Walker had lied about everything and had just mysteriously disappeared. Ben went on to kill himself later that night, and for a horrible while Emma had feared that Dan might do something similar. It all worked out okay, after Lolo and she hadn't thought about any of it in a long time, but this night's events, and particularly the discussion topics that followed, brought it all back only too clearly. This was the first time Emma and Clark had been alone together in a while, as both were always busy with work and didn't normally have all that much to talk about. Both were much closer to Dan than to each other, but they were bound for life by a common bond that no one else but him could ever understand. As Clark gleefully tucked into a huge plate of wings, Emma couldn't help but notice that he'd put on more than a few pounds. He was big enough to hold them pretty well, but Emma knew that if he was still in the public eye, there would have been plenty of magazines and gossip websites picking up on it with close-up pictures and snide captions highlighting the offending areas around his cheeks and his jawline. Having seen herself mocked more than once for having a few hairs out of place on a windy day, she knew how it went. When Emma first arrived in Birchwood, the fact that Clark, and more importantly Dan, were relatively presentable, had made her initial job slightly easier than it might have been. The intervening year hadn't been nearly as kind to Clark's appearance as Dan's, partly since Dan's original hairstyle and general presentation allowed so much room for refinement, but largely because of Clark's complacency surrounding the fact that the physical demands of his police career didn't come close to those of his earlier military days and private security work. And although both were the kind of men who were occasionally described as handsome in passing when being discussed for more important reasons, neither regularly had their looks highlighted up front. No one had ever spoken or written of Emma Ford and her handsome client in the way they'd often spoken and written of Dan McCarthy and his bombshell PR guru, for instance. But new paparazzi pictures of Dan, which featured in semi-frequent Where Is He Now type articles, did tend to include captions complimenting his recent appearance. Are you worried about him? Clark asked very suddenly, mid-mouthful rather than between mouthfuls. You look worried. Emma pulled her eyes away from the door. Are you? Clark appeared to think deeply about this for several seconds, as though he hadn't expected the simple question to be turned back on him. Eventually, he shook his head very slightly. He's not going to tell anyone anything. But are you worried about him? Emma asked. You know, his state of mind. If he'd shown me that whiteboard yesterday, I would have been seriously concerned. You said it. That stuff about Helig and his family did look like something you'd find in a serial killer's place. But he didn't show us it yesterday, Clark said. He showed us it tonight, right after something weird as hell happened in the most conspicuous place it could have possibly happened. So what do you think now? It was Emma's turn to hesitate.
I think we need to support him without getting his hopes up too much, and especially without putting any ideas into his head about telling anyone else what we know. He's just so unselfish, she said, almost sighing out what should have sounded like a compliment. Sometimes I don't think he understands what would happen to us if it ever got out that we've known about Walker's lies for this long without exposing them. Obviously, that's nowhere near the worst bad thing that would happen in that scenario, but it is one bad thing. We would be absolute pariahs. Our lives would be over.
There's no sense in worrying about something that's never going to happen,
Clark said, clearing his plate in near record time.
The secret's safe with Dan. Every little bit of it.
C-minus 88. Port-au-Français Research Station, La Grande Terre, Kerguelen Islands. Over the course of a painfully long hour, Billy Kendrick had spoken only a few times to the GSC Security Corps officers who were holding him in the eerily quiet room where he had been entertaining his tour group just a short while earlier.
You idiots have no more authority to call the shots on the whole of this island than you would to call the shots in the whole state of Florida,
he snapped after several failed attempts to get any information out of them.
Having a few staff in a space-related research station doesn't mean that everything else in the vicinity of that station falls under your control.
The men ignored these comments as totally as they had ignored every other before them, leading Billy to reluctantly resign himself to the fact that all he could do was wait for someone smarter than these idiots to show up. As yet, he had seen no activity on the other side of the room's window, through which the incredible bolide had announced its arrival earlier in the morning. Billy was starting to strongly suspect that the GSC staff on the island were as clueless as he was about what would happen next, and that the organization's top brass had probably told the grunts on the ground to keep him under close observation until further notice. He imagined that such notice would come at the moment when someone with a brain finally realized that he didn't know anything about the bolide that hadn't already gone around the world via dozens of recordings made by his tourists and the island's resident researchers, but there were still no clues as to how far away that moment might be. The two officers in the room weren't even looking at Billy, and he felt confident that he could have easily made it to the door and ran outside had there been anywhere to run. Unfortunately, there wasn't, since without ground transport, there would be no easy way back to the safety of his ship and the friendly faces of his many tourists. Just as his boredom was building to a level of physical discomfort, such feelings long having replaced annoyance and fear as his primary state of being, a large wired telephone to Billy's left began to emit a dim red flash. It wasn't ringing out loud, but a call was definitely coming in. The men, paying no attention, were none the wiser. The building Billy was sitting in had nothing to do with the French National Center for Space Studies, and as such was supposed to be free from direct GSC oversight. The officers also had radios strapped to their waists, so Billy thought that whoever was calling was more likely to be friendly than hostile, and quite possibly someone from the ship who knew which building and room he'd been inside when the meteor arrived. Nothing to lose, he thought, reaching slowly towards the still-flashing handset. He trod a careful line between being quick enough to answer before the caller gave up and being subtle enough to not startle the observers until he had the phone in his hand and could reveal that he was being held against his will. Billy shifted his chair slightly and reached further.
Just a little further.
The two men began to laugh heartily at a joke Billy didn't hear, both of them looking the other way and paying even less attention than before.
Almost there.
C-minus 87. McCarthy Residence, Birchwood, Colorado. Fed up of listening to uninformed speculation about the Kerguelen bolide, and fed up of hearing second-hand analysis of footage he could see as clearly as the people discussing it, Dan decided to try and get a first-hand report from someone who had witnessed the incredible event for themselves. He reached across his desk and picked up the telephone, which was wired to a line upstairs, like all other connections in the signal-blocking basement. With the phone in his hand, Dan dialed the long number he'd been given by Billy Kendrick many months earlier. It rang and rang until eventually someone on the ship answered. It wasn't Billy, but rather a member of the crew who kindly agreed to transfer Dan to the building where Billy was supposed to be. The crew member told Dan that she didn't know if Billy was still there or not, since there had been no contact from his group since the bolide. She didn't sound concerned about this, adding that she'd been told the island was under lockdown to make sure everyone was safe and that they'd all be reunited before too long. And so it was that Dan once again sat with the phone to his ear as it rang and rang and rang and stopped. The silence on the line wasn't total. It definitely sounded like someone had picked up.
Billy?
Dan asked, very tentatively.
Dan, is that you?
Billy replied, his voice loud but distant. Another distant voice then entered the fray, this time one Dan didn't recognize. It echoed Billy's.
Dan? Dan McCarthy?
The man's accent sounded European, maybe Dutch, but Dan couldn't be sure. He was equally unsure of the more important question. Who was he? A third individual provided the answer only too soon, much louder and much closer.
This is GSC Security Corps Kerguelen Command, his gruff voice boomed. State the reason for your call.
Dan didn't speak. His mouth was frozen.
Mr. McCarthy, state the reason for your call.
Once again, Dan's voice failed him. He didn't know what was going on and wouldn't have known what to say even if he'd been able to speak. Try as he might, all attempts to force out a reply came up short.
Don't worry, Dan. I'm safe, Billy called, still distant. I have over 100 international tourists and a full crew sitting on a ship on the other side of this island. Godfrey's black shirts can't keep me here for long. Don't worry about me, Dan. I'll be out of here soon.
Mid-word, the line went flat. Helplessly listening to the uncomfortable sound of a dead tone from a basement on the other side of the world, all Dan could do was hope that Billy was right. Thursday. C-minus 86. White House, Washington, D.C. For several hours, President Valerie Slater steadfastly resisted growing calls to issue an official comment regarding the Kerguelen bolide. Like other leaders, Slater was a strong public supporter of the GSC. But, just like those same other leaders, she hadn't missed the general feelings of resentment that had been building among her citizenry towards Chairman Godfrey's organization. As laid out in the New York Agreement, signed at the United Nations to create the GSC a year earlier, non-intervention from national leaders was a foundational principle of the truly supranational organization and was utterly required for Godfrey's position to retain the authority and credibility necessary to keep so many moving parts in check. There had never been anything like the GSC, which had already structurally consumed all former national space agencies and now exercised arm's-length control of their daily operations while setting the broader agenda and working towards total integration, and a united front among the governments of its member states was something of which they all understood the importance. Internally, many in Slater's government considered the most important result of the New York Agreement to be that China's near-term space ambitions had been halted. Few, however, had much confidence that the GSC would be around to hold back the Chinese plans for a lunar colony and Martian research base for very long. Indeed, many held tremendous skepticism that the GSC would exist in even a decade's time. Balancing the competing national agendas of the GSC's primary member states and handling truculent populist leaders from elsewhere was a difficult task, and one that few expected any willing candidate other than William Godfrey could ever prove capable of performing. And since the GSC's charter restricted any individual to only one single 5-year term as chairman, many expected that the post-Godfrey leadership contest would inevitably descend into mudslinging, which would bring to the surface all of the latent divisions that Godfrey alone could control. Only 1 year into its life, President Slater had been strongly advised to begin preparing for life after the GSC. China and Russia would already be doing the same, she was told, and the subject of a joint venture between private enterprise and the public sector was one that interested many in Washington and beyond as a way for the United States to regain top spot in an era when blowing China out of the water with public investment alone was no longer a feasible or realistic proposition. Slater had already received countless requests for a few minutes of face-to-face time since the Kerguelen bolide.
with some anti-GSC interests calling for her to twist the knife into Godfrey over the lack of advance warning, and others more simply stating that the incident served as a reminder of the foolishness of ceding sovereignty over any security-related matters to a supranational organization. Of course, the security experts who made the latter point and suggested how Slater should respond to the bolide didn't need to worry about the extremely delicate politics of the GSC. And, as if it was needed, reports that an American citizen had been forcefully detained by GSC Security Corps personnel led to even greater calls for an official comment. It didn't matter that the citizen in question was Billy Kendrick, a man widely detested in political circles for his tireless attempts to find a conspiracy in everything he ever saw. All that mattered was that GSC goons had roughed up an innocent American civilian. More than any celestial event, this was the kind of thing that made it difficult for President Slater to stay quiet. A bipartisan call for condemnation ultimately pushed her into authorizing a simple statement which expressed great concern at the precedent, but took care to remind everyone that Billy Kendrick wasn't just any old tourist, and that a research base on an isolated island wasn't just any old place. The incident wasn't as black and white as a plethora of headlines were making out, Slater said, and that was an important point to bear in mind. This kind of deft touch in the face of loud voices calling for strong responses to relatively minor issues of the moment had kept Slater high in the polls and out of any major controversies over the past year, allowing her reputation to recover from the horrendous few months after the IDA leak. Slater couldn't help but notice that Dan McCarthy had also stayed quiet about Kerguelen so far, keeping himself out of the public eye as he had consistently tried to do for so long. McCarthy's willingness to move on from some unsavory incidents and keep to the fringes showed Slater that he was more mature than she'd initially believed. She also knew, however, that his sensible restraint was likely to be at least partially attributable to the influence of Emma Ford, who the president begrudgingly recognized as a potent message manager. The celestially intriguing and politically unfortunate incidents at Kerguelen, while admittedly newsworthy, weren't in themselves anything that posed much immediate difficulty for President Slater. But amid whispers that early observation data seen by American GSC personnel was already raising eyebrows about the bolide's true nature, she wasn't foolish enough to think that things weren't quickly going to get a whole lot more complicated. C-85. Garden of the Gods Park, Colorado Springs, Colorado. An excited ACN reporter stood in front of a spectacular sunrise next to the equally spectacular Balanced Rock, a worthy backdrop for everything from a Caitlin Judd movie poster to the sun-faded family photo which had survived several changes of refrigerators to remain a constant feature of the McCarthy's kitchen for as long as anyone could remember. The fantastical landscape was the kind anyone might have readily believed to be part of an alien world if they hadn't seen it before. And Dan had taken delight in imagining just that when he had visited as a child and gazed at the majestic sandstone pillars and logic-defying rock formations. As birds chattered in the distance and the most eager of the day's many human visitors arrived, the reporter continued in a serious tone as she cited unconfirmed reports that all GSC command centers were operating at the highest alert level. For viewers at home, her report cut to a snippet from a brief radio interview GSC Chairman William Godfrey had conducted overnight. His face filled one side of the screen with his words transcribed on the other as he spoke. Godfrey refused to be drawn on claims that Billy Kendrick, now safely aboard his tour ship and heading towards New Swabia, had been detained without justification by GSC staff for several hours.
"I can't think of anything less worthy of our time than that man's transparent attention-seeking," Godfrey said in an almost disinterested tone. "That said, Billy's make-believe detention probably is the most newsworthy thing to have happened at Kerguelen in recent times. The airburst was an unexceptional event which happened to occur in an exceptionally scrutinized region, and that's really all there is to it." I'd like to take this opportunity to assure your listeners that despite the corporate media's typically sensationalist reporting of the incident, there truly is no reason for alarm, or even for any particular excitement.
But despite Godfrey's typically statesman-like comments, alarm and excitement were the only two moods of the moment. Massive crowds were widely expected to form at Lake Toplitz and Lake Namtso in anticipation of something extraordinary, while vastly increased attention was also being paid to the less accessible sites of Bouvet Island and New Swabia. As the ACN reporter revealed on her return to the screen, staff and volunteers at the picturesque Garden of the Gods Park behind her were also expecting today to be their busiest day ever, and for the weekend to break that record once again. Recent numbers had been great, thanks to the park's appearance in Caitlin Judd's new movie, but the frenzied media speculation surrounding the Kerguelen bolide was sure to ramp everything up to all new levels. But this park wasn't the only nearby spot where major crowds were expected, as illustrated by an advisory police notice which had been issued to warn citizens against traveling to the highest traffic Fincher Trails to the west of the city. The so-called Fincher Trails, with which everyone was familiar, owed their name to the recent re-emergence of a 19th-century prophecy which some believed to hint at the location of the fourth plaque. The relevant words had been penned by Humphrey Finch, an undistinguished English art collector, in a self-published pamphlet entitled The Prophet Finch, which was read by almost no one until recent events appeared to add credence to one particular prophecy. It had also been noted with intrigue that precisely 140 years had passed since the pamphlet's initial publication, exactly half of the 280-year timescale established by the alien plaques, and thus, according to some straw-clutching analysts, perhaps the precise time needed for a one-way journey between their world and Earth. The key passage in question was by now known to almost everyone over the age of 10. A triad of great discoveries will bridge the gap between soil and star, arising from the shadow of the Alps to delve the depths of the Silver Ocean and gaze upon the rockiest peak that lies beyond. And as anyone who hadn't been living under a rock for the past year could attest, the revelation of a Nazi-era discovery at Lake Toplitz, high in the Austrian Alps, had directly led to two alien plaques being found off the Argentine coast. As soon as the rediscovery of Humphrey Finch's prophecy was reported in a small English newspaper, along with a note that Argentina's name was derived from argentum, the Latin word for silver, the story went global. It didn't matter that nothing else in the pamphlet's 20 pages had been correct. Finch's words, which no one could deny were noteworthily coincidental, sparked great and long-lasting interest. Some called it Fincher fever. Some called it plain old hysteria. But whatever it was called, the phenomenon had caused a deluge of plaque hunters to descend upon the areas around several Rocky Mountain peaks, and many of them now devoted a great deal of time and energy to locating the plaque based on Finch's prophecy. The imprecision of Finch's final words, "and gaze upon the rockiest peak," was a source of great debate among the community of plaque-hunting enthusiasts who had themselves come to be known simply as Finchers. Some insisted that rockiest peak was not necessarily synonymous with peakiest rocky, and thus that prominent peaks as far afield as Mount Robeson merited as much attention as the obvious choice of Mount Elbert, the highest of all. Some name-conscious Finchers were drawn to Argentine Peak, which owed its name to an initial silver discovery, which preceded the Colorado silver boom of 1879 by a full 15 years. Other plaque hunters who understood that the fourth plaque couldn't possibly be found in the wilderness and that it must instead have already been in someone's possession, like the third had been in Carl Heilig's, diligently researched potentially forgotten collections in silver boom towns like Leadville, Creed, and Aspen. The often romanticized Pike's Peak Gold Rush of the late 1850s attracted even greater research interest. Pike's Peak, despite being the specific site of no gold discoveries for several decades, proved enduring as a beacon-like symbol of hope for old-time prospectors due to its visibility from great distances to the east.
To many, this made it the natural candidate for the designated rockiest peak in a prophecy which had already explicitly established a westward direction of travel. And for the prophecy's many committed proponents, this logic opened up several major cities which owed their foundations to the gold rush, including the likes of Boulder, Denver, and Colorado Springs. More than a few Finchers believed that the final part of the prophecy referred to the plaques falling into the control, if not possession of, Richard Walker and his Colorado Springs-based Interspace Defense Agency. These Finchers, whose internet forums Dan McCarthy paid keen attention to, spent their research hours retracing every step of Walker's political life with a particular eye for any conspicuous meetings in the vein of his infamous rendezvous with Hans Kloster in Bonn. But when it came to the other subgroups of Finchers who were literally searching in the mountains, Dan couldn't for the life of him understand why they thought the plaque could be there. He could only roll his eyes when he saw people moving across the country and setting up camp near the high-traffic trails as though participating in the real gold rushes of the past. The senseless nature of this treasure hunting didn't bother Dan personally until a young online celebrity fell to his death while live-streaming his own attempt to find the fourth plaque, and tragically paying too much attention to his phone and too little to his footing. Another two Finchers had died since then, and Dan struggled with the guilt of knowing that people were dying in their attempts to search for something that wasn't there. Emma and Clark calmly but firmly reminded him that the chaos that would result from lifting the veil on Walker's hoax would significantly outweigh a handful of isolated accidents, but logic didn't always trump emotion. Another individual who wrestled with his conscience over these deaths was Timo Fiore. Following a short-lived bidding war with the Silicon Valley hotshot, Timo's remarkable $1 billion bounty for the plaque's discovery was responsible for a great deal of the recent fervor. He nonetheless refused to bow to political pressure to revoke his offer, insisting that someone else would still offer a high enough amount to ensure the searching continued as zestfully as ever. In a rare public interview, Timo explained that he saw it as the responsibility of a man in his fortunate position to ensure the plaque ended up in safe hands, i.e. his own, but that, as far as he was concerned, the responsibility ended there. Such a serious amount of money had naturally attracted some equally serious search expeditions, ranging from organized teams of civilians to venture capitalist types, and even rich athletes who deemed investing in a search team to be a shrewd move given the size of the prize. Dan and Timo both imagined that state interests were looking, too, but the impenetrable secrecy of such groups meant that there was nothing to follow on that front. President Valerie Slater, for her part, had thus far maintained a firm and unbudging position that William Godfrey's GSC had no business searching for anything within the borders of the United States, which put many individuals at ease that the fourth plaque wouldn't end up in Godfrey's questionably motivated hands. For Dan, this was the crux of his keen interest in the existing search. He had no reason to believe that the fourth plaque was currently anywhere on Earth. But wherever and whenever it arrived, and for all he knew, the Kerguelen bolide may have been a sign that the time was now, he had to find it before it fell into the wrong hands. Dan didn't yet understand why the messengers would risk such a thing, but he understood that it would be more than a little egotistical to assume they would deliver any message into his lap when it was meant for the whole of humanity. All he hoped was that they were smart enough to drop it far enough away from the laps of any self-serving liars like Godfrey and his kind. All around the world, Fincher-like search parties had sprung up. Anywhere even tangentially linked to the key sites became a point of concentrated interest, with every location ever visited by anyone implicated in the supposed cover-up quickly seized upon by locals keen to get in on the plaque-hunting fun. But one key site in particular was about to emerge at the forefront of the world's attention, and the surprised look on the ACN reporter's face suggested that some unexpected news was currently filtering through her earpiece. The general story she was hearing, which regarded a security incident at Lake Nantso, was newsworthy enough. But if some of the specific details were correct, the political fallout would be immediate and could possibly eclipse even that from the Kerguelen Bolide. C-84. Lake Namtso, Tibet Autonomous Region, China. The idyllic region around Namtso, one of Tibet's three holy lakes, had for the past year been feeling the strain of an unprecedented and unexpected explosion in visitor numbers. Tibet's relative physical